The views and opinions of shows on KCNR are those of the hosts, guests, and callers only, and do not necessarily reflect those of the staff, management, or advertisers of KCNR Radio.
Good afternoon. You are joining We the People Radio with Aaron Ryan.
And Bill Cundiff.
And Bob Martin.
Look at that. We got the hang of it, you guys. That was like the best one yet.
Oh, man. It's hard.
Everyone has their microphone on. Everyone has their headphones on. Bill's got his on backwards.
I don't
everything.
Oh, I do. Dang it. No, I don't.
You know, some things just, you know, I count on them.
No, I got mine on
He just likes them. He just likes them like that.
I like my left being my right being my left.
Exactly. So, of course, my computer needed
a contrary.
I'm going to wash with dirt this time. Oh, my gosh. So, we're calling our guest here right now, and we'll be talking about his book. It's called Pharmaphobia, and it's not farm like...
Like afraid of doing farm work?
Yeah.
Not afraid of the goats?
You're afraid of cows. No, Pharmaphobia, how the conflict of interest myth undermines American medical innovation.
I got pharmaphobia, and I left home. Hell with that garden.
That explains a lot.
It does.
So basically, Tom. His name is Tom Stossel. He is a medical doctor. So he has written this book. He contends that bureaucrats, reporters, politicians, and predatory laws have built careers attacking the medical products industry, belittling its critical contributions to medical innovation, and accusing it of non-existent malfeasance. Overselling product value, flaunting safety, and corrupting physicians and academics who partner with it.
Wow.
I know. It's quite a mouthful.
I might be guilty of that.
So, you know, it's funny because a lot of times that is the industry people like to point fingers at, and I don't know where that started, but we're going to find out. He's a visiting scholar at the American Enterprise Institute for Public Policy Research. He's a hematologist and a medical researcher at Boston's Brigham and Women's Hospital and Harvard Medical School. Where he is the American Cancer Society Professor of Medicine. So, he's going to talk about all the medical stuff, and we're just going to listen.
Is he John Stossel's brother, though? That's what I wanted to know.
Somebody would say, he knew somebody would say that.
I'm sorry. I might as well get it out
Dr.
of the way.
Stossel, would you like me to pummel Bill for you, or do you want to just come over and do it yourself? it always starts out like that, doesn't it? So we only have an hour with you, and this sounds like a massive topic. And I've listed on our webpage, wethepeopleradio.us, for people that are, you know, not on there already. Just go to the webpage afterward, and you have links to the book and all sorts of things like that. But that being said, give us some input on this, because I read your whole thing, and I thought, geez, I guess I kind of knew this was happening. But it sounds like the consequences are bad for all of us.
Well, indeed. Aaron, first of all, thank you for having me.
Absolutely.
I really appreciate it. First of all, people need to understand that the book, it's Pharmaphobia, spelled with a P-H,
yes.
Not F.
Yes, no, not cows and pigs. We weren't afraid of them.
Right. And I wrote it for two reasons. One was just to get some facts across, so I'll just rattle them off. So, fact one, I'm old. I've been in medicine a long time, almost 50 years. And you hear nothing but whining about health care, the expense, and underinsured, and this and that. But the fact is, it's immensely better than when I started out. And just for example, we live on average 10 years longer, we're 60% less likely to die of a heart attack or stroke, and you just don't see people crippled up with arthritis the way it was when my career began. Now, fact, the reason things are so much better is because of the amazing tools we have to provide patients. And fact, those tools, medical devices and drugs, come dominantly from the private medical products industry, pharmaceutical companies and medical device companies. Fact, those innovations come to us with great difficulty and at great expense. And I'll put some numbers on that in a little while. Okay, so those are facts. And, you know, I find that intelligent, well-educated people, even physicians, don't know those facts. They're not taught in medical school how innovation works. And I didn't even know those facts in the early part of my career. I was in my academic bubble, and it was only when I had some experience with industry that I came to realize that I had been so clueless. So I wrote the book that people can understand. We get great value from industry, and it's really, really hard and expensive. Now, the second reason I wrote the book is because folks I call pharmaphobes came out of the woodwork 30 years ago when I was having my education with industry and deny these facts. They deny it. Oh, no, industry doesn't innovate. It's just profiteers. And it's corrupt. The industry is corrupt, and if physicians or researchers work with it and get paid to do so, they're corrupt. And the code name for this corruption is conflict of interest. Mm. Now, from that came a long laundry list of supposedly specific examples of corruption, and this led to an equally long laundry list of regulations that are now in place that I argue in the book slow down innovation. And so the book, what it does is it systematically goes through these myths, it explains them, and it blows them up.
Nice. So what's the where did it all start? I mean, was there kind of a beginning?
I think it all started when they started eating kale.
And started with what? I'm sorry, I didn't hear you.
Bill wants to blame it on kale.
Kale and Brussels sprouts.
Bill's a kale hater.
Okay. well, maybe, but so the pharmaphobes, to define them, come in different flavors. There are two basic classes. One is what I call instigators, and the instigators are academics who've discovered they can make a living beating up on industry. They get academic promotion, they get touted as experts, and so that's one instigator. Another is, with all due respect, and of course, is the media. And of course, I love the media. My brother and my son is editor of a magazine, and but you know, corruption, whether it's real or not,
sure,
sells copy. And so the media has been a major instigator. The biggest instigators, though, are the lawyers. The lawyers win if they sue you, if they prosecute you, or they defend you. And the more regulations that we have, the happier they are, because you have to pay them to teach you how to comply with those regulations.
And they get paid.
So those
first
are the instigators. Now, the other promoters of pharmaphobia are what I call enabler enforcers. These are the people who run our health centers, particularly academic health centers. And they'll talk the talk about, oh, we need innovation, but it must be done with integrity, with transparency. And as soon as you start that kind of language, especially, we must avoid the appearance of conflict of interest,
sure,
schools out, because the instigators can come in and make anything look bad. And so the enforcer enablers are the ones who've actually made the rules. Because, as I said before, while they talk the talk about innovation, what they really care about is avoiding scandal, not losing their high-paid jobs. And that's been the driving force that's gotten us these rules.
You know, and you see this with, we see this a lot in the West with environmental policy. Same kind of deal. If all the money is going to these academic centers and it's there to prove the government agenda of the, you know, of the anti-environmental people. Well, they're supposed to be the environmentalists, but really all they are is the anti-private property people. And somewhere that's where all of our science comes from. And when a regular guy speaks out, boom, he loses his tenure at, lost his tenure at UCLA. I'm sure there are many others. So it's the same basic problem.
Yeah, how do you argue?
Yeah, and
with,
you know, it's a key word.
You
use the word agenda, key, because the thing about this conflict of interest mythology is it's riddled with all kinds of highfalutin ethical baggage. It's about professionalism. Well, it's about money. So let's another sort of academic instigator class that I didn't mention are the people who manage medical journals. Now, I'm their worst enemy because I have cluttered up the I do medical research, as you said. I have cluttered up journals with all kinds of articles. And so I know that system very well. And it's very important for the advance of science. It's how scientists talk to each other. It's how they get credit for what they've done. But it has very little to do with medical innovation. So it's important to get across that the best game in town for evaluating the quality of safety and effectiveness of products is the FDA. You know, here's a part company with my libertarian brother who would just as soon get rid of the FDA, because I think the FDA actually does, for all of the problems it has, a pretty good job. It has a terribly difficult job because, you know, if you approve a drug or a device and people's ears fall off, your head rolls.
Yeah.
If you don't approve it and we don't get a good product, nobody knows. And yet, it consistently does approve products, and that's how we get those tools and the advances I talked about in the beginning.
And so this
would be an opportunity to sort of lay those numbers down. So it now, on average, takes 16 years and costs $2.6 billion to get a drug approved by the FDA.
Jeez.
That's 100 times more expensive than when I started out in medicine. Now, some of that expense is because the FDA regulation has gotten more stringent, but nowhere near 100 times more stringent. But it's a little bit of stringency has a disproportionate effect because it impacts on a nasty fact, which is that biology is a bitch. So you think, why? You know, we
it
can make planes that fly by themselves and have great high-definition TVs that work great. Why is it so hard to develop a drug or a device? Well, it's because we design those planes or TVs, and we design them to be totally, we can make them totally predictable. We human beings are unpredictable, which actually is a good thing, because bacteria that dominate our world are coming after us all the time, and they can change, mutate every 20 minutes. We can't possibly keep up with that. So if we were predictable, totally predictable, they'd have wiped us out thousands of years ago. So the good news is we're having this conversation because we're unpredictable. The bad news is you put a drug or a device that looked great in the laboratory, looked great in test tubes, worked in animals, you get into clinical trials and 9 out of 10 fail. So the one success has to pay for those 9 failures.
Mm.
I don't know any way to make that easier, guys, but we shouldn't make it harder.
Yeah.
And
well, it's not benefiting anybody.
These regulations that have come into play that separate doctors and researchers from the industry, that keep industry representatives from talking to doctors about products, and then stupid trivial stuff like the drug rep can't leave a cup of coffee or a bagel to when she talks to the doctor, on and on and on and on. That slows it down, and that's a bad thing. That's sort of a long-winded digression from the medical journals.
No, that's
come
okay.
Come back to that.
Okay, hold that.
The managers
hold that
of the medical
thought.
Journals deny that they don't want you to know that the FDA is the best game in town. They want to take credit for it because they're selling information. So, once again, it's an agenda. It's about making money, and the medical journals have been in the forefront of selling the pharmaphobe message.
I can only imagine. All right, we're going to come back with Dr. Stossel in just a flash. You're listening to We the People Radio. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us.
Body. give such delight.
Oh, we're going to hear the whole song. Hey, you're listening to We the People Radio. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us. We are here with Dr. Tom Stossel. We're talking about his book, Pharmaphobia, and this is the PH Pharmaphobia. The subtitle is How the Conflict of Interest Myth Undermines American Medical Innovation. And so, Dr. Stossel, talk to us about this, you know, the type of regulations that have been adopted because of the, because everybody believes that there's this conflict of interest thing.
Right. Well, the first set of regulations that came in with it focused on research, and it was based, they were based on the theory that if you were paid by companies, you would lie and cheat to appreciate stock. And those rules, and so the effect was there were universities established sort of nanny pharmaphobe committees that would look over researchers' shoulders and would decide what research they could do, what rewards they could get, and in many cases they decreased rewards and told researchers that they couldn't do certain kinds of research. And in the 30 years that those rules have been on the books, there hadn't been a single case of lying or cheating for that reason. So we were talking about the academics. Occasionally, you hear about scientific fraud, research fraud. It happens. It's heinous. It should be punished. But 95%+ of papers that are retracted, published papers that get retracted because of fraud, are published in medical journals and have no commercial connection whatsoever.
Hmm.
And it makes perfect sense because the FDA will never approve a product that's based on fraudulent data. And so the oversight is so much more stringent on the commercial side than it is on the academic side. So the theory is wrong, and those rules just get in the way of constructive research. So that was the first set. And then what sort of came in were the things I referred to before. They're based on the theory that marketing, that industry's marketing to physicians is corrupt. Well, guess what? Once again, the marketer, the drug rep, the device rep can only say what the FDA has approved. And I've hammered away that the FDA's information is the best game in town, as opposed to, you know, your local hospital advertises it has the best doctors. What's the evidence for that? I hope it does, but there's no regulation of that whatsoever. So increasingly, practices, first it was in academic centers, but in, even in non-academic health systems, they ban reps. Reps can't come and talk to the doctor. Well, stuff's changing all the time, and you want your doctor to be up to date. You want your doctor having access to as much information as possible. So say that your doctor can't talk to a company rep who is providing FDA-approved information about which the company knows more about than anybody. That's bad. That's potentially bad. But that's where we're going. That's where we've gone. Samples, which used to be given to patients, can't do samples because it promotes the use of expensive brand products. Well, you know, you come in your doctor's office and you got sky-high blood pressure. It would sure be a good thing if the doctor had some samples to give you and get your blood pressure down. Or your dermatologist gives you some goo to put on your itch, and you say, hey, that feels good. Now you're more likely to go and fulfill the prescription. And we have a terrible problem with non-compliance with prescriptions. Anyway, I could go on and on about that. But let me give you a couple of examples of regulations that have come from this pharmaphobe mentality that are really bad. So one is a 2.3% tax on medical devices that is part of the Affordable Care Act. Now, the reason that tax got slapped on is because Congress bought the pharmaphobe argument, the denial of those numbers I gave you. Oh, it's not that expensive and difficult. They're exaggerating. Tax them, tax them. Well, the big guys, the big companies, they can afford to pay the tax. But the problem is that the cutting edge of innovation is occurring in small companies running on fumes. And those guys can only get their products to you if they can have an exit through the big companies. And if the big companies are frittering their assets away, paying taxes, that's less likely to happen. And the small companies then have no choice but to turn their lights out. So another incredible example of a regulation that's been fueled by this, pharmaphobia, is something called the Sunshine Act. Have you heard of it?
No, but I think I have the idea. I mean, they you have to make everything public?
Yeah, exactly. So, but get this. Any payment of as little as $10 from a company to a physician has to get reported to the federal government, and you can go on a website and look it up. Now, it's amazing that the shallow thinking, oh, how can we be against transparency? What's wrong with knowing this? Well, you got 15 minutes to spend with your doctor. You want to talk about your symptoms or who's paying the doctor? It's the last thing you want to know. What's your doctor's training? What's your doctor's track record? What's your doctor's bedside manner? You know, this is a distortion of common sense. And it's insulting. You know, $10. A doctor is going to be bribed by $10. That's ridiculous, and I can tell you where that comes from. But it's not just that it's insulting, but it's really, really expensive to do that reporting. It's very complicated. So keeping track of who's paying whom and reporting it is costing billions. That's money that ought to be going to medical research, product development, and medical education, but we're frittering it away on this transparency.
Sure, and we're also paying somebody to go sift through all that minutiae to what end? You know, how has that helped the patient?
Well, I mean, as I said, it's useless for patients. You can't interpret it.
Sure.
You know, if I do a clinical trial, and I do it through my hospital, and the clinical trial costs $1 million, that appears on my roster. I don't do clinical trials, so I don't have that problem. But it's, you know, how would you possibly interpret that kind of craziness? Now, I'll tell you who does take it. The only people who take advantage of this are the muckraker media and the pharmaphobes, who are constantly looking for corruption. They haven't found it in 30 years, but they're confident that with all of this minutia, they're going to find it. So there's an outlet, which you probably have heard of, called ProPublica.
Okay.
They, you know, because the media business can't afford investigative reporting anymore. So this outfit, I think it's based in Chicago. It feeds the outlets with stuff, and they've taken this on big time. So they go to these databases and they look up and they shame doctors and they make them look bad. But here's my favorite. A couple of years ago, they correlated doctors who were getting paid. They found that the doctors got paid by industry and had been reprimanded by their state boards of registration. So you can imagine how this got sold. You know, corrupted doctors on company or bad doctors, flawed doctors on company payrolls. That's what my local paper said.
Nice.
Parroted this stuff. Okay, so I actually debated one of these reporters on national TV. And he said, we found hundreds of doctors who were reprimanded. Hundreds. Well, actually, it was 250 out of 17,700. Now, you do that math.
Yeah.
And that's three times lower than the average rate of being reprimanded by your state board. So actually, being paid by industry is a pretty good test of integrity. Didn't say it. Now, unfortunately, on that program, I missed the opportunity to make that point. Instead, the reporter who was interviewing me on TV said, Dr. Stossel, I see you got $2,000 from Pfizer. What's that about? And I said, Well, it's because I'm good. I add value. If I wasn't, I'd be a reporter.
Ouch.
No, but of course I don't apply that to you guys.
Well, no, because we're volunteers and we just do this on Sunday. So
okay,
our thought was to bring ideas and information that you don't hear in the regular media to the airwaves, so people can actually learn stuff. So stories like yours usually get, how long are your interviews? Like 3 minutes, 5 minutes? They're usually probably
pretty
small.
Well, it's interesting. I've been talking to, conservative stations. In fact, I'd say pretty much 100%. I'll tell you a story about the one exception that didn't happen. But so, what's really been interesting about I'm really enjoying this media work is that what has tended to happen is I have 15 minutes or 10 minutes, and as I'm doing my shtick here, I can sort of feel the wheels turning. That the host, who usually is pretty clueless, not like you guys.
Oh, thank you.
You can sort of, gee, maybe this is interesting. Gee, maybe this is important. So a number of these, in fact, I'd say maybe 15% have been extended to 30 minutes, 45 minutes. And so I talked to my brother, who's done thousands and thousands of these things, and he says it's never happened to him. And
really?
The only explanation I can think of is it is so off the beaten track. And maybe it's because it's about your health that people kind of get it, maybe we ought to have this information. Anyway, that's been the experience.
Well, that's
good. I'll tell you about the one. So we have a local station, an NPR station, and I was asked to be on it, but the format it takes is that they bring an adversary in. There's somebody who debates you.
Sure.
Which is fine. But they couldn't find anybody to debate who would debate me. So they canceled it.
So they wouldn't let you get the information out unless they could.
Censorship, in a way.
Sure. They had to find you a foil. Well, we see this all the time. I don't know if people realize this or not, but I think most sensible people who realize that, CO2 makes plants grow, they realize that all these IPCC scientists, when you start doing the numbers and looking at who's who, it's not the majority of scientists. It's just the majority of the ones that are paid by the big universities and that fund the agenda. Those are the guys you hear from. The other guys that are out there trying desperately to get the word out, and so now they've applied that logic to the pharmaceutical and medical device industry. Interesting. So we can all pay more, which is what it always necks down to.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it is the galling, the sort of arrogance. There's a lot of disrespect in what I'm dealing with. It's the idea that doctors are bribed by $10. It's really disrespectful.
Yeah, no kidding.
The arrogance is it's not if we go back to the global warming, it's not going to be my trillions of dollars that's spent to do what to do whatever we're going to do to solve a problem that may never happen.
Yeah, that they can't really prove. But if they don't keep everybody inside the corral, they can't keep the narrative alive. And some of this is the same way. And I think people have gotten comfortable bashing industry. And I think it's very good that you're putting it out there that actually costs you. We need to take one more quick, we've got actually two more quick breaks, but this is one of those. We won't take them all at the same time. We'll be right back. We're speaking with Dr. Tom Stossel, who is a visiting scholar at the American Enterprise Institute for Public Policy Research here at We the People Radio. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us.
After my eyes have seen the years and the slow parade of fears without crying, now I want to understand. I have done all that I could to see the evil and the good without hiding. You must tell me if you can, doctor, my eyes. Tell me what is wrong, 'cause I am wise to leave them open for so long.
There's a lot of doctors that tell me that I better start slowing it down. But they're more old rocks than they are old doctors, so I guess we better have another round. Well, now I gotta get drunk, and I sure do.
Well, there you go. Another regulated industry. You're joining We the People Radio. We're here with Dr. Tom Stossel discussing his book, Pharmaphobia. It describes how an ideological crusade stretching over the last quarter century has used distortion and flawed logic to make medical innovation even harder in the misguided pursuit of theoretical professional purity. I think that... So when people go to get a hip replacement or, you know, that kind of stuff, we hear a lot about this medical device tax. Those of us that haven't ever... you know, done that or aren't old enough or whatever, or didn't break in the right spots. How is that? I know you said there's a 2.3% tax because of Obamacare, but what are they doing to innovation with all this?
Well, as I said before, we discussed how difficult and expensive it is to get innovation. And the, you know, some years ago, Procter & Gamble, you know, used to make drugs. They stopped. They said it's too risky, so they only do consumer products.
Yeah.
There comes a tipping point where we've talked about 9 out of 10 projects fail, and the one success has to pay for the nine failures.
Mm-hmm.
And you say, hey, you know, I got stockholders. I got to keep the lights on here. We're gonna stop making drugs and devices. We're gonna make dog food because it's a lot less risky. And so that's the problem. That's the frittering away of this tax. And as I said before, it's the denial of the difficulty and expense that's how that tax got put on in the first place. The equivalent for drugs, it hasn't become overt, but there's a lot of pressure, and a lot of doctors are clamoring for price controls. So if you think about this, that we are the only country that doesn't control the prices of drugs. They're sort of under the table rationing schemes that the states allow pharmacists to substitute generics for brands, and there's lots of negotiation behind the scenes. But the fact is that the main profits that the companies make that they need to keep innovating come from sales in the United States. So what happens is the other countries which have these single payer government systems control the prices. They make, say you want to sell your product in Germany, you're going to have to sell at a lower price. And for the companies, it's a no brainer. Don't sell it at all or sell it at a discounted price. So that's what they do. And the result of all that is the entire world is freeloading off of American medical innovation. Now there's probably nothing we can do about that, but The call here is we need to rein in these prices. Now, medical product spending is about 13% of the trillions that are spent in healthcare in general. So most of the spending goes to hospitals and to doctors. And, of course, everybody's trying to point the finger at everybody else, you know, to blame them for high costs. In the book, the companies have done a very poor job of explaining why they need to be profitable and defending themselves, and so as a result, they take the brunt of the hit. And, of course, the way it works out in practice is you go to your doctor, the doctor sees you, you prescribe something, your insurance pays for the doctor visit. Now you go to the pharmacy and you try go to fill the prescription, and oh my God, I have this huge copay,
mm-hmm.
especially for some new drugs, some of which are you may have heard of this new drug that cures the liver disease, hepatitis C. It's extremely expensive. And so in a big sticker shock, everybody's upset. You complain to the doctor, and the doctor who doesn't really understand the economics of innovation says, oh, these companies should be lowering their prices. We should have price controls. Now, well, you know, while I think while the Republicans control Congress, it ain't going to happen, but, you know, that sort of situation may not last forever. And if these bad ideas that still have innovation if we control prices, that we may end up going there. Another way this gets played out is say, oh, the reason these companies, of course they could keep innovating, because they spend all this money on marketing. Well, they have to market. A product, no matter how great it is, if the doctor doesn't know about it, she won't prescribe it. If she does not know how to use it properly, it may hurt the patient. So the marketing is important. It's an integral part of the value chain. And if the companies stop marketing and their sales go down, then for sure they're going to stop innovating.
Is some of that
the reasons that we discussed before?
Well, is some of that the reason that they're marketing directly to the public? You know, that we have to sit through, hours of, I just can't believe they put some of these things on television with the side effects they have to actually say.
Well, that's the FDA. See that?
Yeah, who's doing that?
It is kind of crazy. They spend a lot on it, which, of course, that the pharmaphobes then say that's shows that this is making them profitable, and we really don't have a great idea about what it actually brings in. But I can see that people's tastes are offended when there are Viagra ads at the Super Bowl and that sort of thing. But the fact is that this direct-to-consumer advertising often deals with stigmatized conditions.
If
it brings to the attention of the patient, gee, maybe I can get something for this, they go to see the doctor. And let's just take erectile dysfunction, the Viagra thing, that can be caused by diabetes, it can be caused by high blood pressure, and if a direct-to-consumer ad gets you in your doctor's office, and the doctor checks your blood pressure and checks your blood sugar and then treats you for those conditions, you're better off. So I think on balance, it has value. The quality in the is something else again. I mean the rattling off the side effects.
I know that's just
I don't get
a rule,
that because that should be the doctor's role, not the TV's.
Yeah, and some of it you think, gosh, that would have been better as a print ad with some really small print at the bottom.
Well, nobody reads the print ad either.
Well, that's the point.
The fact that if you really were good and have all those horrible side effects, what you'd never want to take the drug. So,
hey, I've got a question for you. Talk to us a little bit about the kind of the rift between the pharmaceutical companies and the homeopathic industry with vitamins and minerals. I mean, you hear a lot about that. These folks that are pushing the vitamins and the minerals, and if you take that, you don't need all these pharmaceutical drugs,
and those are unregulated.
Right, right. Well, so tell your listeners that after they buy and read my book, Pharmaphobia, they should read a book by a colleague who's a good guy named Paul Offit, Offitt. He is a pediatrician and a vaccine specialist in Philadelphia, and he wrote a book called "Do You Believe in Magic?" And he talks about the question that you raised. And what I was fascinated to see is that he's very hard on they're called nutraceuticals,
right.
The supplements,
sure.
And all that stuff, and the way it works. Is there if the FDA determines that they are and the lingo is generally recognized as safe GRAS, then it's open season. Companies can market it, but they have to say then that this has not been approved, and but it gets a little hokey because they'll say clinical studies have shown, clinical
that's
studies
really
aren't
common.
Anything like what the FDA forces the drug and device companies to do. I would say but what I learned was that one reason that this industry is so gets such an easy ride is because celebrities have bought into it. And celebrities are politically powerful. And so that has been a big force in keeping these things from being heavily regulated. Now, he's very down on them. I think he's offended by the intellectual dishonesty. I'm cut him a little more slack because I think on balance, this is really a stretch, but it's one of the great things about this country is we're so affluent that we can afford to buy stuff that just doesn't work. but we can believe it works.
Well, you know, I brought that up with my doctor here, it was probably a month ago. We got to talking about the vitamins and minerals versus the drugs, and he actually got a little bit defensive, and I don't blame him, but he said, I'll tell you what, he goes, go ahead and just quit taking everything I've prescribed for you, and go ahead and get on all the minerals and vitamins and everything, and you come and see me in a couple of months, and we'll see if we can get you back on track again, because it doesn't work. It's all a bunch of smoke and mirrors. It may not hurt you, but it's not going to do what these pharmaceutical drugs do.
Well, this is fun, too, because I just looked up his book, Do You Believe in Magic? The Sense and Nonsense of Alternative Medicine, and he has like a black hat with a bunch of stuff flying out of it, like a magician's hat. So we'll have to have him on. He looks fun.
It's a good read, and it's an important thing. You know, I think that I would try not to be defensive, but I think that, you know, as I say, it's a free country. People can do what they want.
Yeah.
There probably are times when people go after these things when they should be on real drugs. That's not good. And there have been some very high-profile cases of that. Occasionally, these things are contaminated and hurt people. But, you know, and what actually is I find most amazing, and actually this is something we can talk about, is the FDA is very stringent about what companies can say about drugs. You know, like all that gibberish about side effects. Yet, these nutraceuticals can say anything, pretty much anything that they want. And that advertising is solely going to patients, to lay people who have no training and background. Whereas the highly regulated FDA information, the drug information, is going to doctors who are trained.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, the FDA is much tougher on the companies about what they can say than they are about these nutraceutical things.
Pretty darn interesting. I think we should have him on here.
Notice to some, you see the media reports of these huge fines that drug companies have paid. You know about that?
No, but hold on. Let's take a really fast break, and then we'll come right back and go to the top of the hour with that one, because that sounds interesting. You're listening to We the People Radio. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us.
In all disinfection, just send in $1.98. Get rid of that running nose, that nagging cough, that sneeze, that wheeze. Other than these, take the wonder drug that cures all your ills. Take Jeremiah B. by his poly unsaturated, quick as all the fast acting, pleasant tasting, green and purple.
Nice. I'm sure that's in. I'm sure that's in the book about Do You Believe in Magic? At least we have the theme song all picked up for that show. Oh my gosh, we're here with Dr. Tom Stossel. We're discussing his book Pharmaphobia, not the one with the cows and the pigs, but the one with the drugs and the medical devices. And bottom line is, our paranoia about conflict of interest is actually costing us not only money but innovation, which obviously is stupid. So anyway, we should be we should require people to make more sense than that. That's just silly. And we have somebody on the phone who had a question here in our last few minutes, so we better hurry and do that, or they won't get to ask. Fire away. Hello.
Roberta.
Hello. Hi. You did not come on right away.
Well, we're sorry about that.
You were there from my side.
No worries. What's your question?
Okay, I don't have a question. I have a comment.
Fire away.
I disagree with some of the things being said. However, the main thing I disagree with is he mentioned that supplement companies can say anything they want. That is not true. When they say when they make claims, it is illegal, and they can be brought up on charges. And so companies that are making claims are doing it at risk. So
okay.
I wanted to correct that. You cannot tell your neighbor that chicken soup helps the cold without a risk of being brought up as practicing medicine without a legal license.
Okay, we have like 2 minutes left, so let's let him answer here.
All righty, thanks.
Hey, thanks for calling. Dr. Stossel.
I had a little trouble hearing, but again, the gist is that I overstated the reign that the nutraceutical people have, and it's true, there are limits to what they can say, and that's absolutely correct. But what I was, and I'll try to do it very quickly, is that the I think the real point is that the control of what the drug companies can say is much more stringent. And so a doctor can only prescribe a drug that's been approved for something, but the doctor can prescribe it once it's approved for anything else. That's called off-label prescribing. The companies, on the other hand, can only promote their drugs for what has been approved. And so if you can imagine that there were some gray areas, and that in the past companies would push the envelope a little bit and the FDA would slap them down, but recently a new occurrence has been that lawyers, prosecutors, gone after these companies under what is called false claims. False claims are billing the government for stuff you didn't do. And in this case, what the prosecutor has to prove is that, because it's the doctor that writes the prescription, it's the doctor that is billing the government, so that if the company's marketing caused the doctor to do the prescribing for an unapproved use. And that's a very hard case to make. You could probably never win a case like that because the doctors are trained and educated and so forth. But a lot of the conflict of interest, the paranoia, comes out in these indictments. But what ends up happening is the companies never defend themselves. They always settle and end up paying billions of dollars in fines. And the reason is the punishment for getting a conviction in this false claims legal strategy is something called debarment. I have never seen that word in a media report of these huge, when they talk about these huge fines. Debarment means your company cannot do any business with the federal government for any of its products. That means no products sold to Medicare, Medicaid, Veterans Administration. That's capital punishment. That's why these cases always settle.
Now that
and
figures.
There, the consequence is that billions of dollars, which is what these settlements are, once again, diverted from research, product development, and education to paying off these fines. And it's an extortion racket, plain and simple.
We love it. So we'll recommend people get the book, read it, learn stuff. We have been discussing this with Dr. Tom Stossel. Our time has run out here at the top of the hour. We so appreciate you being with us, and sounds like we might have to do it again.
Well, thank you so much for having me. Enjoy the rest of the day.
Thank you. We'll be back with the second hour. You're listening to We the People Radio. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us. Good afternoon. You are rejoining We the People Radio. Second hour, we're shifting gears. We're moving on to water. And this actually affects everybody, but we'll be Northern California for the next hour. We're speaking with Mark Baird, who is a rancher and a regular guy who's been with the Protect Our Water, I guess we'll call it, group. It's an ad hoc group up there in Scott Valley, and they started working on this, God, how long ago, Mark? 4 years?
Oh, gosh, it's been longer than that. It seems like 34 years. I don't know, probably 2009, 10, something
yeah,
like
yeah,
that.
Something like that. And it all started with Fish and Game, and they wanted their watershed-wide permit. Maybe give folks a little sketch of what it is they tried to do, because then
there's a lawsuit, and now we're talking about the backside of the lawsuit. But maybe give them a little framework if they haven't been following.
Well, this started with Fish and Game's attempt, and you know, remember, this is an agency filled with liars, so the lie doesn't bother them at all. We have a California government that's filled with liars. But what they did was they made up a permit, and they said that all water users had to get it. And what this was is kind of funny. It was like protection money. It was a permit to give you insurance in case you accidentally killed a fish during your routine agricultural irrigation practices. And this permit gave them unfettered access to your land without a warrant. It let them inspect your headworks. It allowed them to mandate changes that you'd have to make to both your water right and your irrigation practices and how much water you took and when you took it and when you were allowed to do it. And you know, at first, nobody really knew anything. We thought, well, gosh, the government's telling us to do something, and we're good little sheep, and we're not really independent thinkers, so I guess we're going to have to do it. And then we started asking ourselves, well, wait a minute. This doesn't seem constitutional when you have the right to property, but the government tells you when you can use it and how much you can use it and how much it's going to cost you to use it. And so we decided to tell them no. We told them we would never get their permit, never ever, bring their gun, arrest us all, do whatever you want, but we are never, ever, ever going to submit to you, your authority, or your permit process. And it was funny because all of a sudden they got scared. The people were starting to have the thought and the depth of understanding of their own rules to know that what they were doing was not only illegal, it was also unethical, and in fact, it was extortion. And when we pointed that out to them, in no uncertain terms over a period of about 2 years, a very contentious period, they went away.
But they didn't go away forever. We'll probably get into that. We just want to make sure that people understand what exactly this 1602 permit says, and that whole idea of substantial and all that, kind of want to make sure we don't skip that, because most, you know, there are a lot of folks out there that think, well, you know, what's the big deal? Get a permit.
Yeah. Well, the 1602 process was a legislative measure passed in the 60s, and it was intended so that large-scale projects, construction projects, that disturbed, quote, the bed, bank, or channel of a river in order to substantially divert its flow. In other words, you weren't allowed to go in the river and build a bridge and take dozers and change the course of a river and take 10,000 tons of gravel out of there without some governmental oversight. That was the clear intent of Section 1600. And then in about 2009 or 2010, 2009, 2010, 2011, and I have direct testimony from Fish and Game employees who have told me this. I'm not making any of this up. Fish and Game, under the astute leadership of Mark Stouffer, the acting regional director, and his liar buddy Neil Manji, who is nothing more than a fish engineer, and now he's the regional manager after we embarrassed Mark Stouffer and they removed him and gave him a better job somewhere else. They decided to say that the act of extracting water for routine agricultural purposes was disturbing the bed, bank, or channel and constituted a significant alteration of flow.
And this isn't something where somebody just goes down to the creek near their house and starts slurping water out of it. This is a water right that you exercise every year, and some people have for 100 years or more.
These are water rights, and they're deeded to your land. When you purchase your property, you're also part one component of the land you purchase is the right to water your ground and the right to water your grass and give your animal stock water and raise crops to provide a decent life for your family and your children. You know, so when you purchase a piece of land, when you look at that land, you also say, well, what is the water right that goes with that piece of land, and how old is that water right? Because that's very important. For example, our water right is from 1859. It's recorded literally in book number one of Siskiyou County. So we have the right, and in California, a water right is a property right, the same as the ground you purchase with the water right. So, you know, we have to ask ourselves a question here. we have something in the California Constitution that's kind of cool. It's called the Charter of Rights. And the very first thing in the Charter of Rights, Article 1, Section 1 of the California Constitution, the very first five lines of that document gives us inalienable rights as free and independent beings. And among those rights are the right to possess and protect property. Well, take your pen out of your pocket and put it on the far side of the table. And then you say to yourself, that's my pen. I own that pen. I paid 69 cents for it at Walmart. But what if I had to call up a government agency, fill out a ream of paperwork, and pay $22,400 once a year, and I'd apply for the permit in January, and by July I still hadn't gotten the permit for the right to reach over and pick up that pen and actually push the clicker button and write my name with it? Is it really your property when you have to ask permission to use it?
No.
And therein lies the problem.
But this is you know, goes along the same lines of what they're doing down the Central Valley with water, isn't it?
Well, it's statewide in California, quite frankly. Like I said, when you have a government ruled by the monoparty, filled with liars, they will use one community's misfortune to set precedent and then attack the rest of the communities. And quite frankly, the goal of the state of California, the goal of the liars in Sacramento, and by the way, the monoparty has a lot of Republicans in it, I got to tell you, their goal is to gain control over all property rights, surface and subsurface rights, in water rights in the state of California, so that they can tax and tax and tax and tax.
And that's kind of the short answer. And they've got their system in place. I mean, they've got enough guys to come and go after everybody. And so you guys wound up. I remember all that. It was very contentious. And every time the Fish and Game would come over the top of the hill there into the valley, the phone lines would light up, and everybody knew where they were. And it was war. So then the Farm Bureau sued.
Yeah, the Farm Bureau sued to define Section 1600. We tried to tell them not to do it. We weren't in any trouble. We told Fish and Game to pound sand, that the people created this government, and their job is to serve the people who created them. And we weren't in any trouble. We had them on the ropes, and they'd gone away. But the Farm Bureau, of course, statewide Farm Bureau and Siskiyou County Farm Bureau are no different. They think they know better than everybody else, so they sued over 1600. And they won in Superior Court. And then Fish and Game, because we don't have three branches of government, we have one branch that all get their paycheck from the same hole, and they took it to the Third Circuit. And the Third Circuit essentially told Fish and Game, what is it you fellas want? Let me write that down. Okay, you can have all of it. So if your child goes to a river with a Dixie cup and takes a Dixie cup full of water out of that river, she is guilty of a violation of 1600 and must get a permit prior to taking the Dixie cup down to the river.
Well, it's not just the state government involved in this, aren't the feds involved in this too?
NOAA's
coming out there and trying to enforce their will.
Like I said, we have a state government filled with liars, and what they do is, when they lack the jurisdiction through state processes to convict someone for running down to the river with their Dixie cup, they pull in the feds, and the feds have a different jurisdiction. In federal jurisdiction, if your shadow as you walk across a bridge scares a fish, you have just as well killed it, and you're guilty of take. Where California's take statute, there has to be a body, you have to prove who killed it, and you have to prove intent and maliciousness in that death. So where Fish and Game lacks even the authority to do the crooked things they want to do, they just bring the feds in. The state of California allows them, because we don't have state sovereignty here. Our governor doesn't prosecute state sovereignty at all. So they just let the feds in to do their dirty work for them.
You know, and it just gets more, there's a lot more to this, folks, so hang with us. We need to take a really quick break. We'll be back with you in 2 minutes. We're speaking with Mark Baird from up there in Scott Valley, beautiful Northern California. You're listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us. And we're back. You're rejoining We the People Radio. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us. We're here with Mark Baird. We're talking about water rights. So, Mark, the Fish and Farm Bureau, sues Fish and Game over the 1,600 permits. They win in Siskiyou County. They get reversed in the other Third Circuit. And that just happened, what, three weeks ago? 2 weeks ago?
Yeah, it wasn't very long ago, yeah.
How long did it take before Fish and Game showed up out there?
Well, that wasn't the case, really. What happened was some of our neighbors on the Scott, and I don't want to make any specific statements because they can and will be used against us in a court of law, because I think Fish and Game intends to try to make a big deal out of this. But some of our neighbors had have a diversion, and of course the river whips over a very wide channel during large flood events, and so this particular watershed had applied for a permit like back in January, and there was no permit forthcoming, and all of this yapping and delaying on the part of Fish and Game, because quite frankly, the power to tax is the power to destroy, and they were using the permit and the delaying process until the water was gone anyway, you know, and then what good is it they hand you the permit 2 days after the river goes underground? So these guys are watching the river decline, and they can't get their water, so a bunch of us went up one day, and we illegally entered a wet area, and we moved some rocks and helped our neighbors gain access to the property that they rightly owned since 1863. So Fish and Game gets wind of it. We think there might be a tattletale involved, but that's another story. And they get wind of it, and now they want to make a big deal of it after the fact. And so we have a meeting tomorrow with, this thing has gotten so far over the top, it's unbelievable, with a United States Congressman's representative, two California State Senators representatives, and one assemblyman's representative. And this is interesting because this points out our lack of representation in the state of California. With one state senator that has to represent a million people, he's not going to show up. He sends staff. And with an assembly person who has to represent a half a million people, he's not going to show up. He sends staff. So we now in California not only have a pack of liars in the state house, but we have government by staff, you know, which is not, I think, what the people intended in the state of California, I don't believe. But yet both of those same senators voted yes on Joint Resolution 30, supporting the worst communist in the building because he says the illegal aliens in his district deserve more representation. I don't know. You can't make this stuff up. You really can't.
Actually, that is pretty much not why they voted that way on that.
No, I don't know why they would have voted that way.
Because if they flip over the redistricting, short answer, if they flip over the redistricting, it resets how many representatives we get in the state, and it eliminates, I think it's like six, somewhere between six and ten conservative districts in the state.
Yeah, we're kind of wondering up here, maybe we need to eliminate between six and ten because they're certainly not doing us any good.
Well, they wouldn't be up here anyway because obviously they'd be in
really need to eliminate between six and ten down there.
Yeah, except for the fact that they'd all be on their own. It wouldn't eliminate the team you want to eliminate. Mm-hmm. I can get you info on that, but so what's the feeling up there with people?
We're going to fight. Our feeling has never changed, not since the very first day we showed up to that first meeting in Etna, California, a couple hundred of us with holsters and constitutions in them. The first paragraph of the California Constitution is that we're born free and independent beings with certain inalienable rights, among them the right to possess and protect our property. So my question to the state is, where does the California Charter of Rights fall into the seniority system of statutory law in the state of California? Is Article 1 in fact a Charter of Rights, or is it simply an advertising statement to get people to look at the Constitution, but it's really the statute and regulation that takes precedent over our Bill of Rights? In my mind, the inalienable right given me by God to my property and its use overrides every statute, regulation, and legislative little attempt to take my property in the state of California, and we will fight to protect our property. period.
Yeah, because at the bottom, you know, at the bottom of it all, without the water rights connected to your property, the water or the property is worthless.
Well, yeah, I mean, water is life. You know, if you control the water, you control the land, and if you control the land, you control the people on the land. And by the way, this has nothing to do with fish. It has nothing to do with the environment. It has to do with power, money, and control. And all you got to do is follow the money, and you go back to places like Earth Justice and the Pew Charitable Trust and the Ford Family Foundation and the Stark, that guy Stark down in Silicon Valley who contributes heavily to environmental causes, and those causes in turn contribute heavily to political office in the state of California, and that's exactly why we demand the state of Jefferson. There is no way out for Northern California except to get away from those crazy people in Sacramento.
Yep, and they, you know, at the end of the day, the agencies are all executive branch. I mean, I know folks want their elected guys in Sacramento, even if they could, to rein them in, but as long as we have the executive branch we have,
I agree with you in principle. However, I mean, when you look at it on the prima facie evidence is this. Governor Brown even says, he says the California traffic infraction system is a deplorable hellhole. Well, that's an executive branch, and he's the head of it, so if it's a deplorable hellhole, whose fault is that? And things like Section 1600, what the court said was, if the legislature chose to define substantial, they would have. And since they didn't, it falls upon the agency to define substantial, and the agency says substantial is whatever we say it is, whenever we say it, and it's different each day, and it's different on each property, and it's different depending upon how you behave. So if you're a good little party member, then your substantial is a lot more broadly interpreted than if you are trying to hold the government accountable, and then your substantial is zero.
And so the immediate move is what? For people who have fish and game hanging, if they do anything, that's just so folks understand, they have interpreted the word substantial. So any substantial alteration. So substantial means anything that they decide.
Well, there are two court-ordered exemptions to substantial, so we got to really be mindful of those because these are important. It is not considered substantial when a child skips a rock across the creek, and it is not considered substantial if you are hiking and you cross a stream or river and you happen to dislodge a couple of rocks. Those are not substantial. Anything else is, and even if you extract water from a water course with a pump and a pipe, you have substantially altered the bed bank or channel. So look out, folks. I've been to Russia. I've been to every socialist pest hole on earth. I've seen it all in conflict and in peace. I've seen people subjugated on six different continents. And I've got to make one statement here. Tyranny never fixes itself. If the people don't act, this will get worse and worse and worse. And we will act here. Now, we do have an opportunity, though, Aaron. Here's a chance for the two state senators and the assembly person who claim to represent us. They can fix this legislatively very easily. They can define substantial as 25% of the creek measured from high water to high water. They can define substantial by saying people have the absolute right to access and use the property they own without government permission. They can define substantial as excluding routine and ongoing agricultural water use. And they can do that with some crummy amendment to some stupid tax bill that the Democrats want passed. That's their chance to show us, do they represent us or don't they? And that's a very simple question.
Sure. Okay, we need to take one more really quick break here, and we'll be right back with Mark. We're dealing with water rights. And, you know, for the folks out there that think, well, I don't live in Northern California and I'm not a rancher and, you know, all the things that maybe you're not, this is coming for you too. Because once they control everybody else's water, especially our farmers and ranchers, where exactly is our food coming from? And I don't know. I always think of those signs I saw down at the Capitol a few years ago with the people from the Central Valley, and they had these ready-made signs, but they had tons of them, and they said, if you love foreign oil, you're going to love foreign food. And
true.
It was very, very true. Alrighty, we'll be right back. You're listening to We the People Radio. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us. Topic lends so much to all our musical options. So Mike's calling back in with a question, but while we're waiting for him, who else is affected by this right away, Mark?
Well, everybody, because first of all, the price of food has gone up at least 20% produce, because California supplies 25% of the produce for this nation. I mean, the price of eggs has doubled over that stupid thing, the chicken law. You know, people really need to look at their dinner plate. In addition to that, the DWR sent out 1,600 curtailment notices to pre-1914 water right owners and threatened fines and prosecution. And some of those water right owners were communities, Mountain Palm, California, McLeod, California. And then when one of the irrigation districts sued the state, Kamala Harris jumped up and said, I'm really sorry. Didn't you understand? These were just advisory only. We didn't really know. We don't have real jurisdiction over those water rights. So we were just advising you of the potential penalties should we choose to take action in the future. And this notice was just an advisory message. Oh, bull. I mean, please, do they take us for village idiots, really?
And I think that was part of what Mike was going to ask you about.
Oh, yeah, I'd be happy to answer his question. You can't make this up. It's so ridiculous.
Fire away, Mike. I think you're on there.
Okay. The point that I was going to ask is discuss the governor suddenly saying the junior and senior water rights no longer applicable, and saying, you know, you got to shut them off. A bunch of towns and of course, ag districts lost their water, all right, and now some of them decided, well, we're going to sue, because the governor can't just do this arbitrarily. And suddenly now Kamala Harris is saying, oh, now, wait a minute, he didn't really mean that as a dictate, it was a suggestion.
I find that very interesting.
I'm sorry?
I said it sure must have sounded like a dictate to the people who received them, because when you threaten fines or prosecution in exchange for a behavior modification or a signature, that's the definition of the penal code for extortion, isn't it?
I thought so.
But the governor does not think so, and he is not accountable to the people of California, and therefore we are not a constitutional republic. We are subjects of the monarchy in California, and we had better wake up to that very, very quickly, or this will be so far down the slop chute, nobody will be able to get it back out.
So well, I fully agree with you, and only the court can take away our property, and only with just compensation.
I beg to differ with you. The court cannot take our property. Only a jury of our peers can take our property.
I stand corrected.
So much for that, huh?
Well.
Mark, what's the, you know, what can people do?
Well, specifically to help us, sign your Jefferson Declaration and let's hurry this thing up. But, you know, there really isn't anything that people in other communities do except start to wake up, get involved. You know, start telling your legislator that you demand representation that's adequate to your needs, not the needs of Southern California, not the needs of the governor's office in Sacramento. You know, we've lost the only window through which we can view the performance of our government when we're not involved. Wake up. I gave a talk in the park down there in Shasta Lake City last night, and what I advise people is you better start showing up and paying attention, because this affects your pocketbook and your ability to use your property and your ability to find and keep a job and your ability to raise your children. And in addition to that, you have a job as an adult. And that job is to secure liberty for your children, and you're failing at that. We're all failing at that. And it's not just in Scott Valley. This is all over California. People had better wake up and start looking at their Constitution. Read that thing. I know it's the joke of the legal world at over 100,000 words, and it talks about school buses and all kinds of crazy stuff. But at least read the Charter of Rights and determine in your own heart whether that means something to you. And if it does, you better start acting.
So for people who have, they live along a creek, and maybe they aren't ranchers or farmers, and they think that they have riparian, well, you did a really nice job of explaining the types of water right.
Yeah, they do have the right to the water, and they don't have to ask anybody's permission if you live next to the river or creek.
And so is that a, give us the elevator speech on what kinds of water rights there are. I figure there's always tons of people who don't know.
Riparian is the strongest. If you live next to a creek, you have some right to the water in that creek for your, quote, beneficial use. In Water Code Section 106, beneficial use, domestic is the highest, and agriculture is number two. In fact, fish aren't even on the list. That deal was made up later on by Fish and Game in order to gain control of your property and your money. So you do have the right to that water, to water your crops, your garden, your home, things like your trees, things like that. Then we have appropriative water rights. That's where someone in the past went down and recorded a right to a river, and if it's before 1914, they nailed a notice to the tree, and they went and recorded it with the county. They dug the ditch, they completed their own projects, and they started using the water. And then once the allocation was full, no more appropriative rights were allowed. And then there are Pueblo rights. Those are really, really old, and there are very few left, and most of those are associated with the older cities in California. And then the final one is a contract right, a permitted right after 1914. And if you have one of those, you have my utmost sympathies, and my prayers are with you, because the state of California can yank that permit anytime they want to.
And their recourse is what?
Your recourse is you can go to court with your money, and you can also use your tax money to pay their lawyer to fight you to gain control of your rights. You have very little recourse with a permitted water right, very little. The state is in the driver's seat on that, and my sympathies. If you are lucky enough to have a pre-1914 water right, join us in this fight and fight like heck to protect your property, because the state is after those 1914 and before water rights with every fiber in their being.
So the outlook for this is what? I mean, it just seems like just when everybody's backed into a corner, they're backed into a corner some more, because all the Oregon guys, they just had their surface water is now, what, a ward of the state, and groundwater too?
Yeah, every water right in the state of Oregon, by administrative law, by the way. And gosh, I tell you what, I've read the Constitution 100 times. I've never seen a provision for administrative law rule over property rights. But if I were them, quite frankly, and this is what we urged them to do during the Bucket Brigade back in, 2001, go down and turn that water on and defy them to make you turn it off. We are the people that created government. People created government, not the other way around. It's 800 years since the Magna Carta was signed. And in the Magna Carta, and by the way, that governor, people believed in those days that the king was appointed by God himself and placed on the throne to govern the people of England, to rule over them. They were subjects of that government. And it was so bad that they were willing to defy God and stick a knife to that guy's throat to demand their life, their liberty, and their property be guaranteed by rights that were codified in the Magna Carta. And they, one of the provisions of the Magna Carta is you will not be deprived of life, liberty, or property except by a jury of your peers, not the king's peers, not the government's peers, your friends and neighbors. And we have that right in our Constitution as well. But it seems as though the statutory and legislative provisions of the state of California, I think in our government's mind, they trump our inalienable rights. And we need to make that case as people, and we had better not fail.
The Oregon guys, what are their choices?
Their choices are the same as ours. They are free and independent human beings, and they were endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights. And Samuel Adams called those the right to life, liberty, property, and the means to defend them. John Locke in the Second Treatise said the natural rights, life, liberty, and property. Benjamin Franklin said liberty cannot exist unless property is secure. They have the inalienable right to property and to protect that property. But if they don't exercise that liberty, their liberty will be lost. They have no avenue in court. The courts are stacked. The courts are paid by the state, oddly enough, just like here. They will not prevail in court. They're going to have to act, just like we are now with Fish and Game.
And Fish and Game has said they're going to do what? Or have they? Have they?
Well, they imply that prosecution is imminent, and we're saying bring it on. We will fight to protect our property. Our property rights are above state law. State law has no jurisdiction over our lives, our liberty, or our property. And we aim to make that case right here and right now.
So bring it, Fish and Game.
Bring it. Whatever you got, but you better bring plenty.
Exactly. And do this for me. There was a guy the other night at your meeting who was talking about having springs on his property.
Yeah.
So I know there are people who have that water that actually originates on their property. Where are they in all this?
Well, if a spring originates on your property, but it then leaves your property, then you have the riparian right to that spring, but nothing else. All waters in the state of California, and this is law from the earliest days of California. This is not something that the kooks in Sacramento thought of. All water in the state of California belongs to the state. However, you can have, as a property right, the right to use the water. So as a riparian right holder, you have the right to use the water as it passes by, but you have no right to that water that goes downhill from your property and goes off your property. Now, if there is a spring that begins and ends on your property, then you have the right to that spring. In other words, if the water never leaves your property, you're entitled to that. It's your water, just like your property. And it's the same with runoff in California. If you own all of the watershed where runoff originates, you can use that runoff for your benefit. But if you do not own the entirety of the surface area that catches the rain, so to speak, I guess, then you do not have the right to all of that water. It belongs to the state. So it's a little complex, but with just a tiny, tiny bit of study, it's pretty easy to get a handle on, and you can see where you are. And people are welcome to call me on my cell phone if they have questions. I don't mind answering questions or trying to help where I can be a help.
Okay. We will. I have not posted that, but I will. So I'll pop that on our site. We need to take one more quick break, and we'll be right back with Mark Baird. We're talking about water rights, and if you want to call us, I realize time's running out, but phone number is 530-605-4567. You're listening to We the People.
Mississippi, she's calling my name. Catfish are jumping, that paddle wheel pumping. Black water keep rolling on fast, just the same.
Oh, black water, keep on rolling.
Mississippi moon, won't you keep on shining on me?
Oh, black water, keep on rolling.
Mississippi moon, won't you keep on shining on me?
Oh, black water, keep on rolling.
Mississippi moon, won't you keep on shining on me?
gonna make everything great. Mama's gonna make everything all right.
That justice is the one thing you should always find. You gotta saddle up your boys, you gotta draw a hard line.
When the gun smoke settles, we'll sing a victory tune, and we'll all meet back at the local saloon.
We'll raise up our glasses against evil forces, singing whiskey for my men, beer for my horses.
We had to play that one. Remember way back in the day, Mark, when you and Craig Chenoweth came on, when you guys first invented Protect Our Water, remember?
Yeah, I do. It seems like a lifetime ago.
It was a long time ago. We played that song, and every time I hear it, I think of you guys. Bound and determined we're going to squeeze that in before the end. So,
yeah, good.
So, okay, so let's say, you know, because you always have lots of different people in the mix, so you have somebody who... Fish and Game comes to them and they say, okay, you can't do the little push-up dam that you've done for a million years. So therefore, your water is just going to go, you know, either down the river or, in so many cases up where you guys are, it just goes underground. So the fish aren't going to benefit anyway. But you can't do it without a permit. And somebody says, oh, I'm too scared to stand up against them. I'm going to do a permit. How much is it?
Well, it depends on the property. I mean, they can be as little as $500, and they can be as much as $20,000. So it depends on, you know, really, quite frankly, because the Third Circuit handed the Fish and Game the keys to the castle, so to speak. It depends on whether they like you or not. If you're one of the good little party members that always participates in the grant projects and you've planted willows along the creek and, you know, you're a good party member and you have the red star on your lapel for all to see, your permit will be certainly cheaper than mine will.
And they can pick and choose, and they have.
Sure, they have. They do it all the time. This is not government oven by the people. This is government oven by the agency, for the agency, for the benefit of the agency.
How much money do you think they'd raise on it?
Well, quite frankly, the Third District handed them, like I said, handed them the keys to the castle. In fact, they got more than they even asked for, because now there's a potential in California, if every water right owner applied for their little permit like the court wants them to do, they will get 45,000 new permit applications every single year. And even they aren't prepared. So even though they claim that they've always insisted on this permit, oh, we've always demanded that permit. That was the lie that Stouffer and Manji told, under oath, by the way. They perjured themselves in court. No, it's always been the legislative interpretation that in order to take what Stouffer called a Dixie cup of water out of the river, you need a 1602 permit. Well, if that's the case, why are they unprepared for the potential for 45,000 new permits every single year? And so they claim that they're going to engage in a selective process. In other words, they're going to go to the bad people and they're going to ask for a permit, but the good people, they'll let them have the water without a permit, at least temporarily, until, oh, guess what? They can hire a lot more people because they're going to have a lot more money now.
And we all know that they would spend that really wisely. So if somebody, you know, even if they were going to apply 45,000 new permits, they couldn't even process them.
Well, I mean, you take my water right. It's a bad water year. Everybody knows that. Mm-hmm. You know, the western United States has been subject to these mega droughts for thousands of years that we can determine off tree ring data. So you take the case of my diversion where on April 1st I'm allowed to take the water, but I only actually received water for 3 or 4 days. And then the creek dropped to a level where I just wasn't able to get the water anymore. Well, really, am I going to apply for a permit in January, and all they have to do is drag their feet until April 10th, and I wouldn't get the water anyway, but I've got to pay for the permit whether I get the water or not? I mean, gosh, in anybody's mind on this planet, how does that compute?
Yeah, how does that work?
Yeah.
Do you guys have to file reports of use, or is that a whole different thing?
Well, it's somewhat a different thing because that's under Department of Water Resources, not CalPile. So we don't have to report to CalPile our flow, but it is mandatory that you report your flow. And here's the interesting thing. DWR knows exactly what your water right is. They're the ones that have the file with your water right in it. They're the ones that have the maps that show where your diversion is. They know exactly how much you take, and they know exactly when you're allowed to take it. So our contention here is, and they have some big computer program that everyone is supposed to ferret their way through, and believe me, you have to have a master's in mathematics in order to complete this report. A lot of people have tried, and they can't physically get through it. Some of the people here don't have computers and don't want them. But DWR insists you do this on the computer, so we're just not doing them. If they want to know what my water right is, open the file. And if they want to know how much I take all of it.
And you've got it. And the guys that are the people who do have to report to DWR, it's kind of important to note that they're supposed to report that all on computers too.
Yeah.
So you have all these people who live out in places that don't have a computer, and and they told them to what, use the library.
I called up the guy, Ritter, I think his name is, in Sacramento, to explain to him, you know, if you have a process and you would like that process to succeed, wouldn't it help you if you enabled people to be successful in completing the process? A lot of people here don't have the education to run your computer model, and they don't have a computer, and they don't care about those things, and wouldn't know how to work it if they did have one, and don't care about that either. And he said, well, go to the library. And I said, well, that'd be great, except we don't have a library here anymore. Well, get your kids to help you then. And I said, well, my son has, first of all, no interest in helping me do this water report and lives in Oregon, and it's none of his business whether I do the report. I wouldn't even ask him to help me. And why would he care about helping me do this report? I said, no, you make a one-page deal, and here's what it should say. Are you taking all the water? And the answer is yes, and you already know that.
And so if you have to have a permit, do you still have to do this report?
Yeah, everybody has to do the report, whether you have permits or not, whether you take the water or not. You still have to fill out the report.
Wow. So how many agencies are involved? You've got Fish and Game, who's issuing the permit. You've got Water Resources, who's keeping track of how much you used. Where's North Coast Water Quality Board in all this?
No, God, those liars, yeah. They're the ones that they declared most of the streams and rivers in Northern California impaired. Though they don't have any science that tells them what the river looked like before it was impaired, so they would never have a way of knowing what it looks like when it stops being impaired again, and they don't make any distinction between a natural impairment. In other words, if a creek runs over a vein of lead in the mountain, and by the way, that is a mineral, in case people don't realize that. People in Sacramento don't know that, by the way. They think it's made in a factory somewhere. Then the river, let's say, has some lead content in it because it runs through a vein of lead. They make no distinction, and if the river's impaired, it's up to you to fix it. And so I asked David Leland, the liar from the North Coast Board, what was the temperature of the Scott River before it became impaired? Oh, we don't know that. Well, how do you know it's impaired? Well, we made a model. Well, where did you get the information from that gave you the baseline for the model? Well, we made that up.
Oh,
and I said, well, what's the object of having this become unimpaired? Well, we have a plan for what we think the river might just possibly be capable of achieving. Oh, and by the way, you taxpayers are going to pay for all this nonsense.
And one of the impairments, the one that blew my mind was temperature.
Yeah.
Temperature is a pollutant, I guess, in their mind. Yeah. And so it's too warm, and that's you guys' fault.
And
under your control.
Yes, and also if a river has dirt in it, and you know, I don't know where they went to school, but where I went to school, they taught us that river deltas are kind of a natural function. In fact, it's more or less a geologic function that mountains get littler, the dirt goes in rivers, it's carried to the mouth of the river, that forms a river delta. In fact, the people in Bangladesh, they thank God for dirt in the water, because their entire country is built on the Ganges River Delta, and if it wasn't for erosion, they wouldn't have a country.
Maybe we need to send our guys over there to take a look at that.
I think we need to send our guys back to kindergarten so that they can learn how to read and write.
Well, there is that. And, and we have 15 seconds left. Hey, Mark, thank you so much for taking time out of your day and illuminating the issue up there, because it's coming for everybody, honestly. If they can get away with it up there, people who don't even live on creeks are going to pay the price. Absolutely.
There's only one answer to this. The time has come for 51. If we don't get away from them, our lives here functionally and with property and liberty are over.
There you go. And it's JeffersonDeclaration.net.
That's correct.
Okay. And we've got that online. Thanks a million. So now that you're all mad, have a great day.
You know, it's funny. I'm really not mad.
I know.
But sometimes it's frustrating.
It is frustrating. Always frustrating.
Yeah, thanks, Bill.
All right. Thanks, everybody. We'll see you next week.
All right. Thanks. Bye-bye.